welcome to Central Standard Friday. Good morning. My name is Russ Simmons, and I'm with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM, and I'm the one that helps out on film criticism. So that means, obviously, it's Film Critics Day here on Central Standard Friday. And I'm joined today around the table by...
Good morning. It's Marie Asner who paddled in this morning with the Metro Voice News on airprep.com and phantomtollbooth.org.
And I'm Eric Moline. I write for scenestealers.com and also do reviews for three stations in Topeka, Kansas First News.
And there's a lot of goings on in the movie business today. We're going to be also talking after the half-hour break at 10:30. We're going to be chatting with a special guest, Doug Stone, who's a box office analyst, former executive at AMC, and is now known by his website, boxofficeanalyst.com, and he is the expert in this. And we're going to be obviously asking for your call-ins. What do you want to know about box office, and what does it mean to you? And we'll be chatting with him about what it means to Hollywood, and that'll be after the break that we take at the end of the hour. We have a lot of blockbusters that are coming up, but there's one of the blockbusters this summer that you want to talk about that maybe hasn't opened yet that you've been looking forward to. Go ahead and give us a call at 816-235-2888 or send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. And, of course, the big opening today is the Will Smith extravaganza Men in Black 3, obviously the third installment in the wildly popular franchise. It's been a few years since we've seen Will Smith on the screen, and this is a special effects-laden extravaganza. But you know what? The best special effect from my point of view in this movie is Josh Brolin.
I knew you were going to say that. I haven't seen it, but I had a feeling just from looking at the trailers.
Josh Brolin plays a young Tommy Lee Jones. What happens in this particular movie is that Agent J, played by Will Smith, has to travel back in time to 1969 to try to save his partner, played by Tommy Lee Jones, who is Agent K, from certain death at the hands of an evil alien. And in this particular case, the younger version of Agent K is played by Josh Brolin, and it's amazing. He absolutely nails Tommy Lee Jones' persona. Not only does he look like him and sound like him, but he's got the mannerisms, and every aspect of Agent K that we've learned from the first two movies that Tommy Lee Jones has brought to the role, Josh Brolin personifies it just in a younger version, maybe somewhat less cynical version. But I found this wildly entertaining. The movie's not great by any stretch of the imagination, but it has a lot of creative elements that we've come to expect. It's in lockstep with the tone of the other two movies. So if you enjoyed those other two movies, I think you'll like Men in Black 3 a lot.
This movie is cute. It has some of the warm fuzzies in it. Is it worth $200 million? No, I don't think so. The last 10 minutes are about the best. But fans at the screening that I was at last night really enjoyed it. There are many things that from the first two films that are in this film. The little insects are playing in a band, and we flash for them for a couple of seconds. And the pug dog, his picture is all over, so you remember that. And it brings the ambience of the first two films into this one. It's a story of time travel, and it's a story of trying to save Tommy Lee Jones from being killed in the past, and Will Smith goes back, and does he do it or not? We don't know. I'm not going to tell. The time travel segment is done very well, and there's an actor in there who acts as the person who directs the time travel, and I couldn't find his name, so I don't know, Russ, unless
Michael Schulberg, is that who you're referring to?
I don't
know. The Oracle character?
Yes.
Yes.
He does very good. He steals every scene that he's in because time for him is changing about every 2 seconds. And he'll say, okay, this is going to happen. Oops, no, it's just happened. And he goes along. And we go right along with him. But as soon as he's off the screen, if Will Smith isn't there, the movie just kind of falls apart. I appreciated the special effects that were there. The soundtrack is a great soundtrack, but I'm going to give it probably pushing 2.5.
Wow, you're being hard on this one.
Yes, I am.
Will Smith has charisma to spare, and he turns up the charisma to 11, in this movie. And
right.
And this movie absolutely needs it. Now, I'll agree with you that there are weaknesses in the plot, and perhaps it isn't paced as well as the other two films. But because of Josh Brolin and because of Will Smith, that charisma, I have to say that I do believe that most people who've enjoyed the previous movies are really going to have a good time with this one.
So, well, I was just going to say, I read this thing online recently about how the movie ballooned up to its $230 million budget because they had to stop filming halfway through the shoot because they didn't have a finished script. Could you tell? I mean, were there moments that just seemed to kind of come out of nowhere, or, you know, parts of the screenplay that didn't quite make sense? Or
I can't say that, although I have noticed that with a number of other recent films. I'm thinking that either this is the result of post-production tinkering by the studios that have caused it to have these lapses in logic, you know, or as you say, maybe the script wasn't done. But I didn't actually notice it with this picture.
I think we're going to talk about one a little bit later, actually. I know which one you're referring to.
Okay.
Well, I will say that for that 200 and some million dollar budget, this villain has got the worst makeup job you've ever seen since the 1930s. Wow.
By Oscar-winning makeup artist Rick Baker.
You should have known better.
Wow.
You know, I think that in this particular instance, yes, the movie's not a great movie, but I did find it wildly entertaining, and I think most people will as well. I'm going to give it 4. So with Marie Asner giving it a 2.5 and me giving it a 4, we'll just average that one out to a 3 out of 5 stars for Men in Black, rated PG-13. It's, you know, it's maybe a little violent for the young kids, but it certainly isn't tongue-in-cheek, and so all of the violence, of course, shouldn't be too offensive.
Well, when CSI is in primetime TV, I don't think, in terms of violence, so anyway. Sorry.
Good point. Let's chat about a movie that opened back on May 11th, which a lot of us were really anticipating. I believe it's the 7th collaboration between filmmaker Tim Burton and actor Johnny Depp. And that's Dark Shadows, Eric.
Yeah, this is the one that I was referring to when you mentioned the thing about the script being all over the place. Here's the deal. This movie is based on a soap opera that ran in the late 60s and early 70s that became kind of a supernatural thing where Barnabas Collins, this vampire from the 18th century, is not unfrozen but brought back to life. And Johnny Depp has always wanted to play this character, and he's been pining to do this for a really long time. And, you know, when you've got the clout that he has, when you've got the perfect director, Tim Burton, to take on this kind of gothic material – and to have kind of a winking, you know, a satiric sense of humor. The stars seem to be aligned for this thing to work. And the script, like, it starts out where you think you know what the movie is going to be about. And then the main character at that point, who's not Johnny Depp, disappears for 30 minutes in this film. She's just gone. This whole story is about this young girl coming to work in this mansion. And the moment that Johnny Depp shows up, she disappears, and we're supposed to believe that he's falling in love with her, even though we haven't seen her on screen for 30 minutes. My biggest problem was the script. I thought Eva Green was really funny and deliciously evil as the I'm getting a thumbs down from Marie, but I thought she was really great in the film. But and there were some funny moments, the fish out of water stuff, because he's a vampire now in the 70s and he doesn't know what pavement is or TVs are, and those jokes are funny. But if they were trying to emulate the all over the place nonsensical drop this plot kind of mentality that the soap opera had, then that was bad for a movie. You know, it's like if that was the goal, they succeeded, but it doesn't make the movie very much fun to watch. It's kind of a bore. So Dark Shadows for me, I guess it would be 2.
Marie?
Well, I thought Eva Green was miscast. I thought that was the problem. Excuse me. I think Michelle Pfeiffer probably could have done this role a little bit better. Laura Parker, who has a guest role in this movie, was the one who played Angelique in the soap operas, and she had the same delivery as Michelle Pfeiffer. And I thought, ooh, how nice to carry that one over, but they didn't do it. When Eva Green is on screen, she's way, way overboard. But I agree with you. The funny parts about this are when Johnny Depp meets the 1970s.
Sure.
And some of the things that are being shown in the trailers, like bring out the horses, and we don't have a horse, we have a certain type of car, you know, which has horsepower and so on. I mean, that goes along just really good.
But you would agree that it's bad news when all the funny stuff is in the trailer. Because that's how I felt.
No,
I was like,
no, I caught on to a lot of things in here. It was pleasantly amusing for me. But there's one other character that disappears in here besides the one you're talking about, and that's Johnny Lee Miller, all of a sudden he leaves, and that's it. And he's got, you know, main casting in this role. I thought that the violence was unexpected. I mean, vampires must eat, and so you think it's going to be off screen, but sure, not really. And so for kids to come to this, I would say be aware of, you know, that PG-13 rating. The mood that was set, the ambience of the castle, or the building that they're in, and the fishery and stuff like that, I thought that was very well done. Yeah. And Johnny being able to go out in the daytime and stuff, they handle this nicely. I'm going to give it, I'm going to push it to a 3.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday here on KCUR, and we encourage you to give us a call with your feedback. The number is 816-235-2888, or send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org. I had very mixed feelings about Dark Shadows. Its tone is all over the place. It just can't decide what it wants to be. The fact of the matter is, yes, the funny moments are clever, but there are also long stretches where the movie is taking itself very seriously. And it can never establish that kind of quality where you can go with the flow, because you never know what it's jarring. You never know what it's going to be. Mm-hmm. The saving grace is Johnny Depp. Johnny Depp, you know, I was talking about Will Smith's charisma earlier. Johnny Depp's got it in spades as well.
Yeah.
And he's got great comic timing. And so he's able to make this movie work as well as it does, even though I don't think it works that well. And which is surprising. Tim Burton's movies always look great. They have tremendous art direction, and this movie delivers in that respect. But in almost every other respect, I found it to be a real disappointment. So I'm going to give it a 2. Marie, you're saying 3, and you're saying 2 as well, Eric. So let's go with a 2.5 for Dark Shadows, which is rated PG-13.
I'm going to add one thing, Russ.
Sure.
Jackie Earl Haley absolutely steals his scenes whenever he's on, even from Johnny Depp. As the sidekick who ends up sometimes even sleeping in his car. He's so attached to the family. When the camera goes to him, that's the movie.
There's a movie that opened back on May 11th that is actually getting a wider release today, and it's a British film called The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. And interestingly enough, I've had a number of people ask me about this movie, people that I think probably just don't go to the movies very often because they don't make movies for them anymore, or at least that's the complaint. Where here's a movie that definitely does reach out to an underserved demographic. Marie?
This is a retirement movie. So that's, you know, if you're going to retire, this is, you know, this is a fantasy that people in Britain are going to retire. They have limited income and they see the brochures for this exotic hotel in India. Oh, our money can spread just a little bit further, so we're going to go and sell everything and go there. So it follows a group of travelers. And you know something's going wrong when they get to the airport. And then they have to start meeting with flight delays and losing luggage. And they get there and the transportation isn't there. And all of a sudden they see this hotel, which is really a run-down one. And they know they've been had, but they've got to make the best of it. So we follow the adventures of, for example, Bill Nye and Dame Judi Dench. And what is really poignant about this is that Dame Judi Dench is slowly, in real life, losing her eyesight. And so they had to pace her through her roles so that she knew where everything was. And there's one scene where she's riding on the back of a rickshaw and she's looking out over the city, and you know that she really can't see it, but she's smelling it and you know, hearing it and everything. And that makes the movie very poignant. And her good friend Maggie Smith, who is in here as a woman with the sharpest tongue you've ever heard, boy, she's got a nasty comment for everybody, but really a heart of gold, was the one who helped her in this movie. The different stories are a love in the 60s and 70s, marriages that are going to fall apart, marriages that are maybe going to come together, and all in a hotel that doesn't even have doors in it, that there are birds flying through, and yet they're adjusting. And it ends up being a lot of fun because you ask yourself, what would I do if I were in, you know, a situation like this? And everybody just kind of goes together, and it brings them together very nice and warmly. The young man who has the hotel is the one from Slumdog Millionaire.
Dave Patel.
He's the one who's way over the top, but there's a purpose to this. So the first time you see him, you think, oh, my gosh, take him off the screen. But no, he belongs in that particular role, and we see why. I'm going to give this... Okay, I rarely do this. 4.
Oh my goodness.
Oh yes.
Just to be clear, Judi Dench in real life is losing her eyesight,
but
her character is not.
Her character is not, okay. Right. But I had read this in the promos and stuff beforehand and how they were helping her film this. And so when you see her, you realize the work that she did to make this wonderful performance of hers.
You know, the press has made a lot out of that. I had an opportunity to chat with her a couple of weeks ago, and she says they're blowing it way out of proportion. Yes, I don't see as well as I used to, but it's not, you know, I'm not going blind. I'm fine. Don't worry about it. Of course, she just may be protecting herself, but she is a wonderful actress regardless. And it is the cast, this great veteran British cast of wonderful thespians, that makes this movie work. Because let's face it, the script is very pedestrian. The direction by John Madden, John Madden's a good director, did Shakespeare in Love, but his treatment of this, you know, it's just very standard fare. What makes it work is the cast and the fact that we do get to see a story with a group of people that you never see on the big screen, unless they're in a supporting role or they're in a role that is maybe a dowager character or something like that. Mm-hmm. But here you do get to understand some of the dynamics that people of a certain age are going through. That's the positive end. The negative end, as I say, is just it's not particularly inspired.
Any Oscar buzz?
No, I don't think so. There could be some supporting acting nods, but I think it probably is open too early in the year. By the time the Oscar voting gets around, I think people will have mostly forgotten about it. However, it's doing very well. It's done very well box office overseas and has, I think, done better than some of the projections have been. We'll chat with Doug Stone after the half hour here and see what he can tell us about that, the insight on box office for a movie like this.
Russ, you had mentioned before the program that there's one actress here who it really stands out that people notice besides Judy Dench, and that's Penelope Wilton, mm-hmm. because she's on Downton Abbey, which they are now showing as reruns on PBS. As soon as she comes on, everybody, oh, I remember her from there. She's also in this film.
That's right. And, you know, as I said, it's the actors that make it. So I'll give it 3 based strictly on the actors. Since you give it a 4, Marie, let's average it out to a 3.5 for the best exotic Marigold Hotel rated PG-13. Now, the next movie we're going to talk about is definitely not rated PG-13. It's got a hard R, and it's called The Dictator. Eric?
Yes. So The Dictator is Sacha Baron Cohen's third film where he's actually the headlining character. He's the main guy. This, of course, is the British comedian who has brought us Borat and Bruno, the characters that he created on his TV show, The Ali G Show. And, it's his 4th, I guess, because he headlined a Ali G movie as well, but we don't talk about that one. It never was released theatrically in America. But Borat and Bruno are reality-based films where he suckers people into thinking that he's a real character, gets himself into situations, and his director, Larry Charles, who came from Seinfeld, films all of this stuff, and they put this together, and they try to create a satire of American culture. Well, they're doing it again, except this time it's not reality-based. So there's no pranks. It's completely scripted, and it follows a dictator from the fictional country of Wadia who is coming to New York City, and this is the thing that I found was really interesting about this. He shoehorns his offensive shock satire into the standard formula of an American romantic comedy. And that was really weird because we're so used to him just constantly coming at us with unexpected things. And in this movie, it follows a very traditional path of the rom-com. And it's just jarring because rom-coms are not offensively shocking like this movie is. I have to say that for me, it was like watching the early Zucker Brothers films, Airplane, The Naked Gun, stuff like that. There are jokes every 5 seconds. I mean, there's just a gag a minute, and not all of them land. So it's not a perfect film, but I laughed more in this movie than I have in a really, really long time. And so I think that they know that's how the film's going to be, so they made it very short. The running time's really short as well.
Yes.
I think it gets in, it gets out, and it really did make me laugh a lot. And he certainly up the shock factor from last time with some very explicit scenes, and one in particular that I will never be able to unsee. So thank you for that, Sacha Baron Cohen. But I did enjoy this, and I found myself talking about it a lot and recommending it to my friends who have similar tastes and like this kind of humor. If you don't like shock humor, do not see this film. It will offend a lot of different kinds of sensibilities that you have. I'm giving it a 3 out of 4. Oh, no, is it out of 5?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. 3.5.
Okay.
Not a perfect film, but it made me laugh a lot.
And I don't think Marie agrees with you.
No, I don't
judging
think she does.
The expression I see on her face.
Well, I saw it under a special circumstance. I misread the time of the movie, and I got there when the movie was half over. And so they said I could go ahead and see the last half and then stay and see the first half. And I said, okay. So from the middle part, I lasted 25 minutes and walked out. I mean, we have our limits. I know it's shock value, but there are two scenes in there that, like you said, are embroidered in my mind, and one of them concerns a funeral, and the other one is a birth sequence. Now, I can see the romantic comedies having the birth sequence, and they went way overboard with this one. The funeral part, I thought, was just plain disgusting. So I'm not going to rate this at all, just to say that I would not recommend it.
You know, it's a certain taste. I think Eric is completely right. If you're offended by shock humor, then this movie is definitely not for you. On the other hand, I got to give this movie some props for some really scathing sociological commentary that hits the, you know, the target.
That last scene, yeah,
so
where
much,
he's got the big speech.
Yes, so much of it, you know, just in particularly the way things are today with the, you know, great divisions in our philosophies, you know, Republican versus Democrat, and the commentary that the movie has about, you know, us supporting dictators while talking about freedom, you know, here at home, it really hits the target.
It's still a very subversive film.
It's very subversive.
Yeah.
My problem with the movie is I thought it was way too sporadic in terms of its humor. As you were saying, sometimes they throw stuff up. Sometimes it sticks to the wall. Sometimes it doesn't. But some of it is hilarious, and others of it is just dull. I mean, there are long stretches where you were thinking, okay, come on, get on with it. But it is short. As a matter of fact, I went to a regular screening of this film, and there were 20-plus minutes of trailers, you know, mm-hmm. previews of coming attractions,
yeah.
that were a third of the running time of this movie.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's only 83 minutes,
yeah.
actually.
And so I thought, holy cow, you know, why show up so early? Just don't show up on showtime. Show up, 20 minutes later so you can get there when the movie starts. But I do think that Sacha Baron Cohen is an extremely talented and smart guy. And Larry Charles is the director, and he's the same guy that did the other two films. But as you said, Eric, they're not the shockumentaries. They're not the ambush movies like Borat and
Bruno.
But scripted this time out. But still has a certain amount of shock value.
And why is Sir Ben Kingsley in this movie?
I don't know. He really did look lost, didn't he?
He did look lost,
and,
yeah.
And there were some celebrity cameos. I have to give people like Edward Norton and Megan Fox and some of the other people that show up in this movie a lot of credit for being able to laugh at themselves.
Yes. we won't go any farther than that. You'll have to see the movie yourself to figure out what we're talking about. But I'm going to give it a 3, so we'll say 3.5. Since you gave it a 3.5 there, for The Dictator, which is rated R, and I do want to warn everybody that it does earn it. By the way, we had a call in from Sergio, and Sergio asks, I was wondering, have any of you seen Snow White and the Huntsman? Charlize Theron seems absolutely evil and seems to have given a very interesting take on her character. I know that it screens for the critics next Tuesday, but beyond that, have you seen the trailers, though? Have you seen the previews of coming attractions? What was your take on Charlize Theron?
I think she looks great. I think she looks like she's having a really good time. The movie is unique in that Mirror, Mirror was just out a month ago,
right.
which was a completely different take on the same story. That was a family film, and it was very comedic, and I think they're going for action and romance in this one. So we'll see, you know, which one comes out on top.
They're pushing the costume designer for this movie, for Charlize Theron's costumes, as far as the number of costumes changes that she has and the intricate beadwork and stuff like that. So they're already saying Oscar nomination for the costume designer, but we're not talking about the actors or actresses yet, since we haven't seen the film.
It's time for us to take a break, and we're going to be doing that right now. I want you to be sure and give us a call at 816-235-2888 to join in on the conversation. You can also send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org. And also, hey, we're reading your tweets at kcur-c-s-t. And we'll be talking with Doug Stone, box office analyst, coming up after the break. Central Standard Friday. Hi, Russ Simmons here, along with the other film critics, Marie Asner and Eric Moline, talking about movies that have opened up over the last 3 weeks. We're also going to be joined very shortly by Doug Stone, box office analyst, and he's going to be chatting about the numbers. Why are they important to us? Why are they important to Hollywood? And why is it news? Well, we're going to be talking about that very shortly. First, we have a few announcements, things coming up on the local movie scene. The Tivoli is continuing their performing arts series, which includes a broadcast of the National Theater Live. That's at the Tivoli. The next production will be Frankenstein, which stars Benedict Cumberbatch, who's people will know now. Thank you for
Cumberbatch.
Thank
yes.
you from Sherlock, the PBS series that has really taken off, and his co-star Johnny Lee Miller, who we were just talking about from Dark Shadows, who is they're playing the roles of the monster and Dr. Frankenstein. That's going to be June 6th, 10th, and 13th at the Tivoli. And also, the Tivoli will have the, as part of their performing arts series, the Bolshoi Ballet's production of Ramonda, and that will be June 24th and 27th. And you can find more information about that at tivolikc.com. And also, the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival will be June 22nd through the 28th, also at the Tivoli. And once again, info is available at tivolikc.com. Tonight, at the Rio Theater, there will be a performance by the ballet, from the Academy of the Arts, a ballet performance, which is at 7:15, which will be right before a screening of the movie First Position, which we'll be reviewing here very shortly. It's a film about a ballet competition, and that's once again tonight at 7:15 at the Rio Theater in downtown Old Overland Park. And incidentally, they just converted over to digital projection there, and I understand that the sound quality there now is just absolutely phenomenal. So the digital projection really, it's not just about the picture, it's also about the sound, and supposedly it's sounding really great there now. And also, Real Smart Trivia, that's R-E-E-L, Smart Trivia, takes place at the Screenland Armor Sundays at 6 p.m. So if you think you know about the movies, you can maybe even earn some great prizes by going and competing in a trivia contest there that they're doing every Sunday. And that's, again, at the Screenland Armor in downtown North Kansas City. You're listening to Central Standard Friday here on KCUR. And once again, please join us at 816-235-2888. Send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org, or you can tweet us at kcur-c-s-t. And today we are joined by a former AMC executive who has always been a guy who's been interested in the numbers. And now he's box office analyst Doug Stone. Welcome, Doug.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We're happy to have you. Of course, as I set up a moment ago talking about why are the numbers important, while they're obviously important to Hollywood, they're obviously important to the exhibitors, and they're important Indeed. To you. But how about our listeners? Why are the box office numbers important to them?
Well, my take on it is it's more of an indirect issue with the listeners. I don't know how many listeners. There's a lot of listeners who are crazy about numbers and like to track things and play on Hollywood Stock Exchange or something like that. But most, for the general public, it's more of a marketing concept for the distributors. They want to get the word out on their films. Films have a very narrow shelf life. They have, these days, 90% of the gross comes in about 4 weeks. So the more that the studios can publicize the pictures, and that includes publicizing big numbers, number one at the box office, the more that idea gets implanted into the audience's mind that this is a picture they want to see. And as I say, it's not exactly a direct thing with the audience, but it's an indirect kind of marketing idea that the studios feel is important.
It's good water cooler talk.
Exactly.
Now, you mentioned Hollywood Stock Exchange. Could you explain to us what that is?
Hollywood Stock Exchange, it's an interesting company. It was originally around as a little game to play to guess what the movies are going to do overall. Cantor Fitzgerald picked it up to try and develop it into a commodities futures market for betting on the movies, essentially. I think the CFTC actually approved it at one point, but Congress stepped in under pressure from some of the the higher-ups in the movie production side to quash it, and it's no longer a viable option for there. So they're sitting around. So they've gone back to being just the game that they were. And people play it for imaginary dollars to try and, you know, prove that they're the best at projecting what the picture's going to do over a four-week period.
I think it must have been maybe 15 years ago or so, I noticed that the national news broadcast as well as local were talking about the box office numbers. And I'd never really heard them discuss that before. And I wondered, from your perspective, how did that become news, and how is it that they don't talk about the number one book on the bookshelves, they're not talking about the number one song, but they're always talking about the number one movie?
Well, it goes back to kind of what I said. The movies have a short shelf life, and you need to push the idea that you need to go see that movie as much as possible in a very short period of time. It used to be that, like Star Wars, the original Star Wars played at one theater in Kansas City for a year. Okay, somewhere around along the line, studios got the idea that if they broaden the run out, if they take lots of runs, they'll get all their money faster. And their money will come in faster, they can recoup the money faster, and, you know, they don't lose tons of money on the deferred interest on the film. So when they take more and more runs, now it's incumbent upon them to try and push as much of that money as fast as possible, because there's more film coming out, and you're only in the news for a few weeks. I mean, The Avengers has been number one for 3 weeks. It's going to be out of number one this week when Men in Black opens. So it was a conscious decision on their part to try and use this as a marketing tool for their big films, and to try and get them going, especially when word of mouth, you know, when so many people come see it, word of mouth isn't the thing that's driving a particular film necessarily. Now, some films are a little different. Like you talked about, Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, that's going to depend more on word of mouth and people liking it and good reviews. So,
now, you were talking a little bit about earlier when we were chatting about foreign box office versus domestic. And, you know, what kind of algorithms or proprietary information do you use to try to figure out how these movies are going to do?
Well, I can figure out what it's going to do in the United States. All right. The foreign box office is a little bit of a mystery because they all respond differently in different countries to different kinds of films. Like Kung Fu Panda was a huge hit in China. And, you know, it was okay here. It wasn't as good as Kung Fu Panda 1. And it didn't do as well in other markets. So Best Exotic Marigold Hotel is a British film. Did extraordinarily well in Great Britain. You know, $30-plus million and $20-plus million in Australia. United States, it might get to $30 million, which would be a very good result for it. But, you know, to have it outgross the United States and the UK, that's pretty rare. So it just depends on the film. They all have their different have different aspects to it. Now, Avengers, on the other hand, appeals to everybody. I mean, it's a four quadrant film. Everybody wants to see it.
Four quadrant meaning
Every demographic, age group, sex, everybody.
Gotcha. So.
Well, I had a question about that, actually, the Avengers. So they're not the first, but one of the first to do it so successfully, where they release the film overseas before it comes to America. Is that something that we're going to see happening more? Or
It depends. I mean, I think one of the reasons the Avengers went out early because Europe celebrates a May Day holiday, so they picked up a holiday weekend overseas, and that therein boosted the box office. But most of the time, it's more on these big films. It's more the same time, the same release date. Occasionally, you know, it's going to be there's a reason one way or another why they might push it one way to a different date in the United States or a different date overseas. They might go earlier overseas. They might go a little bit later overseas. That applies to the big blockbusters. And there's also a piracy issue. I mean, the earlier you push it out overseas, the less likely you're going to get contaminated by piracy on a large scale.
So most of the pirates are in America?
No. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's if you wait, most of the pirates are probably that most of the pirated films or piracy sales are coming from overseas. But if they release in the United States, there's always going to be somebody out there who may figure out a way to do it. I mean, not all the piracy comes from theaters. Not all the piracy comes from one place or another. But certainly, if you are able to release it simultaneously in both places, the piracy is going to be less rampant. That won't cut into your overseas box office.
AMC, which is currently headquartered in the Overland Park, the Kansas, the state of Kansas area.
Well, they're headquartered downtown. But they're soon to be moving.
Okay, soon to be. But then as soon as they land in Kansas, I'm also going to use the word currently because we never know what the future holds. They've been negotiating and have done business now with the Wanda Group.
That's correct.
And I was wondering, you talk about figuring out box office as far as foreign films and algorithms and formulas and so on. Are you going to have to change that with such a big giant going over and doing business with a company in China?
Well, no. As I say, most of my research is based on the United States. We haven't really delved into the overseas because it's a lot more – we have a lot more information about what the American audiences and the Canadian audiences are like and don't like. There's less information about, you know, how films are tracking in international markets, and it's much easier to make predictions over here. Now, you know, we'll go into research and say, you know, if this thing is doing so much here, we'll figure something out overseas. But the landscape is changing so quickly overseas, especially in China with a huge surge theater building, et cetera, that I can't make an accurate assessment of what might happen overseas right now, and not nearly as much as I can here. So we'll be focusing on that, but it's just a lot harder to do right now.
What was it that piqued your interest in movies in particular for you to expend your expertise on?
I was born into it. My grandfather and my uncle and a number of other investors and my dad were involved in the Boulevard Drive-In Theater when it opened in 1950. And that was actually my first job, was selling concessions down there when I was 15 years old. And I thought I wanted to be a professor of mathematics. I taught high school for about 3 years. I found out that children were really messy and obnoxious. And I didn't like them very much until I had my own, but I didn't like other people's children. I'm still not sure I like other people's children.
But you really like them in movie theaters, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I like them when they buy tickets, right?
Exactly. So I did it for 3 years and went to work for my dad, who had was involved in Mid-America Cinema. He and another, Lou Vaughn, ran that company. And then we were taken over by AMC in 89, and I've been doing this ever since.
So your interest in movies and mathematics dovetailed nicely here.
Exactly, exactly.
When someone goes to boxofficeanalyst.com, what are they going to find there?
They're going to find statistics on what last week's pictures are, some narrative on what we think is going to happen. I mean, it depends on whether you're a paid subscriber or just a free subscriber. A free subscriber will get access to a kind of update or what's going to happen this weekend, now showing. You'll see... You'll be able to get a weekly email of a report that says, you know, here's the films that are the big films that are opening up. Here's what it's tracking. You know, here's how it's appealing to. Here is, you know, here's the synopsis, who's starring in it, and things like that. The pro subscribers, which, you know, I mean, pros, basically our clients are distributors, exhibitors, ancillary companies who do business with exhibitors and distributors like Coca-Cola or popcorn companies or whatever, things like that. They will see our projections. We have a report on Thursdays that goes out with projections of what's coming up in the weekend, projections for the next quarter, projections for the year, and just a recap of different trends and things that are going on in the business. And we publish 3 times a week.
So. What do you project for Dark Knight Rises?
The Dark Knight Rises, okay, is it a good movie? I don't know. Probably it is, all right? So if it's as good as the last one if it's good as the last one, it's going to do over $500 million. If it's just good, $450 million, okay? If it's bad, it'll do $350 million plus. It just I have a lot of faith in Christopher Nolan making good films, so I suspect this is going to be pushing the $500 million mark, perhaps more. But until we really see it, I mean, you know there's huge interest in seeing the film.
You can join in the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. If you have a question for Doug Stone about movies and box office, or if you have a question about one of the movies that has opened or is going to open, give us a call, or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And as I said earlier, we're also reading your tweets at KCUR-C-S-T. So give us an idea about a movie that has overperformed, like maybe Marigold, and movie that may be underperformed, like Battleship.
Well, I mean, I don't know that Marigold is actually overperformed. I mean, it's a very good film. So when you see a very good film, it tends to perform. I mean, it was a very inexpensive film to pick up. I think that's what Fox Searchlight does very, very well. They identify properties that will do business. I mean, a picture that's overperformed, 21 Jump Street. Nobody thought that was going to come out and do close to $150 million. That picture just hit a chord with its target audience, and they kept coming, and its holdovers are excellent. I haven't seen it. It's not the kind of thing I like. My son liked it, but it had actually, I think he liked it, and a lot of other people, the screening where he saw it, didn't. But that was an example of an overperformance. The Vow didn't overperform. It actually performed about where we expected, given the advance interest in it. Channing Tatum has a very strong strong following, but underperforming Battleship. Yeah, Battleship reviews are bad. People think it's derivative. I mean, notwithstanding whatever you might think in terms of the film, I haven't seen it. I've said before, I have bad taste in films.
What were the projections for the first week of Battleship?
Well, the original projections were about $35 million. We expected it to go on to do about $100 million, given the way we were seeing interest in the film. Then the reviews came out, and people did not like it. I think it ended up about $25 or $26 million when it first opened up. So that narrowed the numbers down to about $60 to $70 million when you project it out. And then when it dropped, it didn't hold over very well. We were settled on that $65 million projection. So.
You mentioned Dark Knight Rises earlier, and I know that Nolan is putting out this film in IMAX, but not in 3D. And The Avengers is in 3D, and a lot of other movies get an extra edge because of the upcharge. Are we going to see more 3D films or less?
I don't know that you'll see more. I mean, I think you'll see a fair number in 3D. It's not going away by any means. It's the default for animated film because it's very easy to convert and very pretty inexpensive. It doesn't add that much to the budget. Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan is not a fan of 3D. He does not like it, and he won't do the film in 3D. It's not, I mean, I suspect that Warner Brothers might have wanted to do it in 3D to get that edge, but these hugely popular popcorn films, 3D does give you a boost, and it does add a few percentage points to the box office revenue, and it does keep you going. Now, they need to be a little bit more. My own personal opinion is people need to be a little bit more circumspect about what they pick up for 3D because a lot of it just doesn't make sense. And doing bad 3D doesn't really do much of a service to the industry.
Now, G.I. Joe, yeah. The sequel that was going to be coming out this summer, mm-hmm. already been highly marketed, highly publicized. Then the junket had been set and all of that. It's been pushed back a year so they can turn it into 3D. Is that really going to make that much a difference from your perspective in terms of box office?
It's going to, yeah. I suspect there may have been other problems. I don't know. It isn't because conversion to 3D is not as difficult as it doesn't take a year to do.
I see.
They pushed it back, and I think it's not necessarily because of that. They may be the reason they want to say that they pushed it back, but it's not that's really not what it is, and there just may be problems with the film. I don't know. I haven't heard much. We haven't really heard a whole lot about whether it's bad or good or indifferent, but I think they want to do a quality job if they are going to turn it into 3D, and they may need to reshoot a few things to make it work right.
I read that Ted, this Seth MacFarlane movie that's coming out that's tracking really well with Mark Wahlberg, has now moved into that spot.
Yeah, it did last week. Ted, I just got the email last week that Ted moved in there. Ted looks, like I said, I'll preface this again. I don't have good taste in movies. It looks hilarious. We saw about 10 minutes of it at CinemaCon, the industry convention in Las Vegas, a month ago. And boy, what they showed us was nonstop funny, and my understanding is the entire film is like that. And Seth MacFarlane showed up and was doing his shtick up there, and he was just raunchy but hysterical.
For the audience out there, Ted is about a man who wishes his teddy bear would come alive when he was a child, and it continues, it stays alive, is that it?
Yeah, his teddy bear is alive. He finds out his teddy bear. He wishes, and his teddy bear is alive, and his teddy bear stays alive, and his teddy bear is a pervert. it's just a raunchy, it's, kind of like Seth MacFarlane. In fact, I think that he's the voice of the teddy bear, in fact.
Do you think this move is going to help the film?
I think it, yeah. Obviously, being over the opening the week of the 4th of July is going to help the film, and that's going to be a good thing for it.
We've had Theodore email in to ask, when are we going to begin to see the video on demand numbers in the same way we look at the box office numbers?
Well, we're starting to look at them. The video on demand numbers are still pretty weak, and they come in. The thing about the video on demand is that they come in. They don't come in on a really strong basis, on a weekly basis. You have video on demand may come in. You'll see a film, and it'll do millions of dollars in this. But the video on demand stretches out over time. It's more like a library. It's more like a rental. If you think about a book, it's on a bestseller list. But video on demand is more like going to the library and checking it out. So those numbers aren't of as much interest, because the numbers on your box office is the marketing gimmick. You've already marketed the film. You've already got that information out there. And the video on demand is the aftermarket from theaters. Now they're trying to push it up and trying to make it a bigger deal. Still having some problems with that. Theater owners are not too happy about that.
We want to go ahead and touch on a few other of the films that have opened, just give you a little quick background and a quick review of those before we come to the end of the hour. So first of all, Marie, tell us a little bit about Darling Companion.
I'll say a little bit about Darling Companion, which opened today, brave little film against Will Smith's Men in Black 3. It's a story about a middle-aged marriage that the husband, Kevin Klein, is a doctor, and the whole marriage has revolved about him. He's a great ego. Diane Keaton, his wife, has got a pet dog that she found. The dog is lost when they're on vacation, and Klein cannot figure out through half of the film why everybody is going after the dog until he realizes he has lost his personal touch, and the darling companion has become the friend to the family, and it's quite a revelation to him. There's a great deal of humor in this, and for those who like the exotic Marigold Hotel film, you will like this one too. It's rated PG-13, and I'll give it 3 stars.
Okay, and one I'd like to touch base on quickly is The Sound of My Voice, and I'm going to call out Andrea Salenzi on this one, because one of her favorite films last year was a sci-fi opus called Another Earth, and actress-writer Britt Marling is back with another sci-fi entry that kind of is a little creepy. It's a time travel movie that will keep you thinking. She plays a leader of a cult who may or may not be from the future. Is she warning of an incoming disaster, or is she really just taking advantage of people? And the movie has, as Another Earth did, it has a Twilight Zone kind of twist to it. So if you enjoyed Another Earth, you will like The Sound of My Voice. And I'm going to give it a 3.5 out of 5. And also Corporate FM. Marie, can you tell us quickly about that one?
Yes, it's by Kansas City native Kevin McKinney. It's a documentary about the demise of radio stations when corporations come in. And I draw a parallel between this film and between the demise of newspapers also, because you can see when corporations come in for money-making, the small newspapers are going to go and the small radio stations, the FM stations, are going. It's very well done. I'm giving it a 4, and it's currently showing at least this weekend for sure in the Kansas City area. Check your newspaper for times.
Okay, that's Corporate FM, and I know it has a lot of local connections with some of the local radio station personalities chatting.
Yes.
And that's not rated, and it gets a 4 from Marie.
There are a few cuss words there when people find out they've lost their job, so probably PG-13.
Chernobyl Diaries is from the makers of Paranormal Activity. It's got a great premise. It's a story about some tourists who go to Chernobyl, to the site, sneak onto the site of the nuclear reactor, only to find that it's not abandoned, that like they thought, it's actually overrun with mutants. And it's another one of those where the handheld camera work gets a little tiresome after a while. It does have some creepy moments, but I think it's kind of undermined by a weak finale. So I'll give it 2.5 for Chernobyl Diaries, rated R. And also, Undefeated was the winner of this year's Oscar for Best Documentary. And it's a story about football team, 2009, from a inner city school in Memphis that has never won a playoff game, and it's their attempt to finally, in its over 110-year history, to win its first playoff game. And it's one of those moments that you get really emotionally involved in this film. It's not a great documentary in terms of its filmmaking, but it's certainly emotionally involving, and I'm giving it 4 out of 5 stars. I think the one of the things that the coach says at one point, which I thought was very telling, he says, football does not develop character. It reveals character.
Yeah, the coach says, play for one another, one heartbeat. And I'm giving it 4 also.
Okay, so that's 4 for Undefeated, rated PG-13. Thank you for joining us at Central Standard Friday. I want you to know that our show is produced by Andrea Salinzi, and our announcer is Danny Alexander. Thanks to my fellow critics today, and also to Doug Stone from BoxOfficeAnalyst.com. Thanks for bringing your expertise to us. I'm Russ Simmons. This is Central Standard Friday. Enjoy your day.